We're going to be back in 2 Samuel chapter number 18. Don't worry, I'm going to give us a recap because I'm sure it's been a while, and so some things haven't stuck in your mind. I know that was the case for me reading back through Brother Tyler's message and reading through some of the texts as well, just to reorient myself to what is happening in the passage. But tonight, as we walk through 2 Samuel, what I want us to really see in the passage that we're going to be studying is this: God's faithfulness in the midst of his just judgment. God's faithfulness in the midst of his just judgment. We're going to pick up in verse number 19 of chapter number 18, but before we do, let me give us a little bit of a backstory context so that we can remember what is going on in this passage as we study. The nation of Israel is currently in the midst of a civil war that has really torn the nation apart and split the royal family. The men of Israel and some of Judah as well have had their loyalties turned away from David by Absalom and are now pitted against King David and those who remained loyal to him. So you have on one side Absalom, the men of Israel and the men of Judah who went with him, and then on the other side you have David and those who remained loyal to David. Many of those within his mighty men have traveled with David. David gets word that Absalom is on his way to Jerusalem with his army. And so David flees from Jerusalem. And no doubt you remember us walking through those passages, how David was recognizing the many people that were going with him. He sends Hushai back into Jerusalem to be a counselor to Absalom, to try to trip Absalom up. And so David is fleeing away from Jerusalem. Absalom arrives in Jerusalem. He has one of the trusted advisors of David who has turned away his loyalty to Absalom, Ahithophel. And so he asks, hey, what should be my next step? I'm here in Jerusalem. What do I do? And Ahithophel says, go now, go defeat David, because if you let David get settled, if you let him escape, rest, recuperate, and bring his armies together, we are going to lose. And so he receives Ahithophel's counsel, and then he goes to Hushai and he says, hey, what should I do? And Hushai says, you need to wait. If you go after David right now, he's going to destroy you. You need to just kind of give a space, trying to bide some time for David to escape. And God grants Hushai's counsel to be favorable in Absalom's eyes so that the Ahithophel's counsel is defeated. And so Absalom waits. He establishes his army there in Jerusalem under the command of Amasa. And then he decides to go out and finally meet David in battle. David's forces gather together. Joab is the general there. And David is sending them out. David wants to go with them to go fight against Absalom. And the men are like, absolutely not, David. You're going to die if you go with us. We want you to stay safe. You're our king. We want to protect you. You stay here. We'll go fight. And as they're leaving, David gives one final charge to his men, and he repeats it several times. No one is to kill or touch Absalom. Absalom is to be saved. That is David's final decree to his army as they head out. And the last time we were here, we covered that battle. Joab's forces are granted favor by God, overwhelm Absalom's forces. It's a complete wipeout, and Absalom's army kind of craters. They start running. They run into the woods. The woods itself are killing people, whether they're falling and tripping and dying that way, or they're getting caught, which allows David's army to catch them. It's just an absolute slaughter. Absalom is fleeing away from this battle. He's on a horse. He gets caught in a tree. And guess who hears about it? Joab. And so Joab decides to go and find Absalom in this tree. He arrives, he commands some men to kill Absalom. And they're like, absolutely not. The king told us, we don't kill Absalom. And so Joab takes it on his own ability and power and goes and he kills and murders Absalom in this context. And so as we kind of end the story that we talked about last time there in chapter number 18, we see Joab demonstrating his consistent ruthlessness in executing his own justice as he kills Absalom in the tree. And that's where we pick up in chapter number 18, beginning in verse number 19. And I'm in 2 Kings. That is not great. All right, let me get over 2 Samuel. Here we go. 2 Samuel chapter 18, beginning in verse number 19. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Then said Joab to Cushai, go tell the king what thou hast seen. And Cushai bowed himself unto Joab and ran. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, but howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushai. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready? But howsoever, said he, let me run. And he said unto him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushai. As we approach our passage this evening, what we will begin to see in this text is that even while experiencing the faithfulness of God in the restoration of his kingdom, David still feels the sting of judgment from the consequences of his sin. We're still getting the repercussions and echoes from 2 Samuel chapter number 11, David's sin with Bathsheba, and then David's consequent murder of Uriah. David is still feeling that judgment in spite of also experiencing God's faithful provision and protection of him. For us tonight, we will see that experiencing God's goodness and forgiveness does not mean the removal of the just repercussions of our own sin. So as we open this text, we've seen that Absalom is dead, the battle is over, tidings need to be sent, the news and report of what has happened needs to be sent back to David. So in verses 19 through 23, the verses that we just read, we saw messengers selected to carry the word of the battle to David. Now that Absalom is dead, the news of the end of the battle must be carried back to David. David was rebuked by the people when he tried to go to the battle in chapter 18, verse number 3. So David is no doubt waiting eagerly. He wanted to go with them. They're like, no, don't go with us. So now David is waiting with bated breath. The whole fate of his kingdom really hangs in the balance. Is he going to get news back that, man, Joab is dead, half your army is dead, the rest are fleeing everywhere, Absalom is on his way here, It's dark and gloomy. The kingdom is lost. Or perhaps he's waiting to hear, man, we got there and we were standing there and they were standing there and we both just realized we're brothers. Why are we fighting? And maybe there was an end to this conflict without any bloodshed. And now Absalom will come and be reunited back with me. And this will be a time of rejoicing as we are all brought to our senses. So David is waiting for the news of what has happened. Joab, though, has broken the instructions and decree that David had given him, choosing to instead measure out his own justice, which we have consistently seen within his behavior. Over and over throughout the story of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, when Joab is on the scene, Joab does what he thinks is right all the time. If it aligns with what David has said, great, I'll follow you, David. But the second what Joab thinks should happen deviates, Joab always goes with what he thinks is right. And we see that played out. Joab has shown us the reality of what happens when we live in a spirit of gracelessness, when we choose to live life doling out our own judgment rather than allowing God to be the administer of justice. You see, Joab is not the person that God instituted as the person to carry out justice within the kingdom. That's the king. David is the one that executes justice. David is the one that makes the decrees that God has given him in that place of power. And David's decree was, don't kill Absalom. But Joab's decision is, I will do what I think is best for David, for myself. And really, it's protecting his own interest. So the news going back, while favorable at some level, is really bad news. And Joab recognizes this. This news that's going back of the victory, but also Absalom's death, is going to be a crushing blow to David. And in fact, it's not an enviable job to run this news back to David. Joab no doubt recognizes that at some level, David has a portion of gracelessness when it comes to dealing with Absalom. So you have two people that oftentimes handle things, situations, and problems with a spirit of gracelessness. Joab doing whatever he wants, and David creating an atmosphere of indulgence to those who are closest to them, to him, refusing to hold them accountable for their unjust actions. And so, no doubt, Joab recognizes, whatever messenger I send back with this news that Absalom is dead might meet an unfortunate end. If we look back in the story of David, we no doubt remember the times when messengers have come to David and shared the news that a king has been killed. What ultimately happened? Those men lost their lives. Now, we would recognize justly in the grave robber situation and the one that is being deceitful, those men justly ended their life by their own actions. And David was just in how he handled it. But Joab, no doubt, is thinking, this messenger might not fare so well. There was a potential, perhaps in Joab's mind, that David would kill the person who brought back the news of Absalom's death. Stepping up in this moment, though, right, there is a need to send the messenger, and here comes Ahimaaz. Ahimaaz has been the trusted messenger for David during this whole ordeal. When David flees and they're needing to get the message from Jerusalem back to David about the council and the plans of Absalom, it is Ahimaaz who is part of that journey carrying that news to David. He is someone who David trusts. He's loyal. He's faithful. And he would have signified good news. He would have immediately been recognized and, oh, Ahimaaz is coming. Good. Oh, man, I am so glad. And no doubt he is one that has a great relationship with all of these characters. The way that we see Joab interact with Ahimaaz, it's clear that there is a connection between the two. There is care for one another. And no doubt Joab is like, if I send Ahimaaz with this news, especially that Absalom is dead, I may be sending Ahimaaz to his death. And so Joab, instead of sending Ahimaaz, decides to send a Cushite to deliver the news to David. In our text, you'll see Cushai, and that's it could recognize and be read as a name, like someone's name, Cushai, but rather it connotes someone who is from Cush, a Cushite. This is someone who was not part of the children of Israel, but was serving alongside David and was one of the groups that had joined up with David during his travels and someone who was loyal to him. And really, we see Joab's kind of indifference and callousness and ruthlessness on stage again. Ahimaaz, I don't want you to go. This may be great risk to you. Cushite, go. Your life is not very valuable. If David kills you, oh well, I care about Ahimaaz. And so the Cushite goes, Joab orders him to go and tell David all that he has seen. Conveniently, Joab is using someone else to inform David of the news of Joab's direct violation of David's order to spare Absalom. Like, Joab knows, I'm the one who killed Absalom, I'm the one who broke the decree, I'm not breaking this news to David. I need someone else to break this news to David. You run ahead. Give me time for David to kind of cool off before I get into the city. And so after the Cushite leaves, Ahimaaz continues to request the opportunity to run the news back to David. He's like, please, let me run the news. I want to be the one that carries this tidings. And it's clear Ahimaaz is excited about what has happened, the great victory, and he wants to be the person that shares this news with David. We can all appreciate the loyalty and desire to be an encouragement that Ahimaaz is wanting to be towards David. Joab's response to Ahimaaz's consistent request, please let me go, please let me go, is that Ahimaaz does not have the tidings to give to David. The word tidings here can indicate the idea of good news. So Joab's basically saying, Ahimaaz, you don't have good news to take to David. There's nothing for you to carry to David that is good because Absalom is dead. But it could also be translated as there is a reward for bringing good news. Either way, what Joab is saying is you don't have good news to share to David, and the reaction you're going to get from David receiving this news is not going to be one of reward. So Ahimaaz, don't run to take the news to David. Ahimaaz, though, continues to push to be able to do that, leading Joab to finally acquiesce and send Ahimaaz after the Cushite to also share the news with David. And no doubt in the back of his mind is thinking, I've sent the Cushite, he's got a head start. Yeah, Ahimaaz, you can finally go, but really the Cushite is going to get there first and Ahimaaz is safe. So I know it's more of maybe a dry portion, right? We just kind of see the ins and outs of, hey, take this message, and there's not really good message, but yeah, sure, you can still go to David. What can we pull from this? What truths, what lessons can we learn from this portion of the story? First that I want us to see is that you and I are not to be the arbiters of justice. Joab, when he takes matters into his own hand, violates the orders of the king who God has established as the arbiter of justice, creates a far worse situation based on his own understanding. David has already made a decree. This is what should happen. This is the justice that I have decreed. And Joab, in the moment, says, that's not good enough for me. I am going to be the one who truly decides what is just in this moment. I am going to be the one that kills Absalom. And in doing so, creates a situation that is dangerous, that is difficult, and that is incredibly painful for David. Joab's life shows what happens when we make decisions entirely based on what we want to happen. It is marred by wickedness and ruthlessness towards the image bearers around him. You see, you and I, when we try to take justice into our own hands, can very easily and quickly shift from a just sense of justice into a very selfish form of justice. Oh, someone hurt me? Well, I'm going to hurt them more. You don't mess with me. Rather, God has called us to have a spirit of justice that says, I'm going to pursue justice where God allows it in the form he allows it, which in this context is the king. Within the context of you and I today, in the justice system that God has allowed to be established and the authority that God has placed into our society. But also God has called us to leave justice to him. God is ultimately the just judge that will give everyone the due recompense for their actions. And so you and I, while we may not experience the full measure of justice that we wish we would experience here and now at the immediacy that we demand it to be done, we can rest that God will ultimately have all justice be done. That's the attitude and spirit of a believer. When injustice is done towards us, we don't pour it back out. We give it to God and we allow him to be the one that repays, not us. Because oftentimes we are blind by our sin and our selfishness. There are times when we think we're wronged, when really we're the one in the wrong. We become so marred and blinded by our own sin that we have taken what is good from others towards our life, and in our minds we've perverted it to be bad, and so I must execute justice against these people. When we live life recognizing that God is the one that holds justice, it allows us to be free from this reactionary, self-indulgent, and ruthless behavior towards those around us. Sadly, this is really all we see from Joab. We never really see a change. There are no doubt maybe some good moments in Joab's life. They are few and far between, and the overarching theme that we see in Joab's life is, I do what I want, when I want, to whatever is going to benefit me the most. Even if that means killing people, even if that means lying, manipulating, I'm going to do whatever I want to get what I want. You and I are not the arbiters of justice. It rests in the hands of God. Secondly, I want us to see that you and I must be careful not to allow spaces in our lives that are not ruled by grace and injustice. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look at this whole revolt that is happening within Israel, The whole revolt's foundation is rooted in the gracelessness and indulgence that David has allowed to go uncorrected. It really starts with Amnon's assault of Tamar. And what does David do? Nothing. And so what does Absalom do? Well, if David's not going to do anything, I have to be the one that takes justice. And so David kills and, or not David, Absalom kills and murders Amnon. And so what should David do in that moment? Hold Absalom accountable for his sin. And what does he do? Nothing. Absalom flees. And David does nothing to reconnect that relationship. And eventually, Absalom comes back. And he sits for 2 years. And what does David do? Nothing. And he allows this anger and resentment to stew in Absalom to eventually create a situation where Absalom seeks to replace David as king over Israel. You and I, as followers of Christ, must stand firmly on biblical truth, calling others to accountability, no matter the emotional connections that we have to the person or the potential changes in that relationship. David consistently does not hold those around him accountable. He never holds Joab accountable for his great wickedness. He doesn't hold his family accountable. And in doing so, he creates an environment where this indulgence creates a lack of grace, and it is sin-fueled, and it creates chaos and destruction and death, because when we let sin go unchecked, that's what happens. We experience the full repercussions of it. David's unwillingness to confront and discipline Absalom has created the situation that will ultimately lead to Absalom's death, and created the situation where David issues the order not to kill him. It's a horrific situation. David, on the one hand, is being revolted against by Absalom. Absalom is his enemy. There must be consequences for this action, but David is still unwilling to allow those repercussions to happen. He's still trying to shelter and protect Absalom. May that be a cautionary tale for us as parents, as spouses, as members together within the church. When we stop allowing repercussions and the consequences of sin to take place, and we protect people, and we don't allow correction to come in and change them, we create an environment where sin goes unchecked. It's what we have to guard against as parents. We have to allow our young people to recognize sin has consequences. And we need to respond to the word. We need to respond in grace. As spouses, there are times when you gotta check one another. Hey, that attitude that you're displaying right now is not Christ-like. It's not a spirit where we indulge. We don't hold each other accountable. That creates problems. And that's what David is experiencing. So we cannot allow there to be a level of gracelessness and indulgence, because that creates an atmosphere where sin thrives. So we see the messengers are sent to David. Let's jump down, verse number 24, we're going to read it. But we're going to see David receives the news of victory and Absalom's death. Pick up in verse number 24. And David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate under the wall and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told the king, and the king said, if he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth, or good news. And he came apace and drew near. And the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called unto the porter and said, behold, another man running alone. And the king said, he also bringeth tidings. And the watchman said, methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man, and cometh with good tidings. And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, all is well. And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, and I knew not what it was. And the king said unto him, turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushai came, and Cushai said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose against thee. And the king said unto the Cushai, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai answered, "The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is." And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." After having been sent after the Cushite, scripture records that Ahimaaz outruns the other messenger and begins to approach the city first. It seems that he has taken a longer but easier route than the Cushai that was on his way to David. Within this cultural context, obviously they don't have telephones, they don't have texts, they don't have radio, they can't signal to David, "Hey, everything is good." And so they would have this messenger system that would report the news of the battle. Within this context, one messenger traveling alone would have been the sign of good news. Two messengers traveling together would have been the sign of bad news. David is at the city gate watching and waiting for the news of the conflict, his kingdom and son's life hanging in the balance. Think of the emotions that are no doubt at play for David at this time. Someone watching and waiting to hear the news of whether or not his prayers of deliverance were answered. Back in chapter number 17, as he's leaving Jerusalem, remember, I believe Shimei is like, "Hey, you're cursed. God is going to remove the kingdom. You're an awful human being," essentially. And he's bringing down curses on David. And what is the response? They're like, "Hey, kill him." And David's like, "No, I'm not going to kill him." And David expresses this prayer to God. "Hey, God, whatever your will is, let it be done," is essentially the heart of David. But David prays for God's deliverance. And so he's waiting to hear, "Did God deliver me? Is my kingdom still established?" And no doubt he's wondering, "What about Absalom? Is my kingdom saved? Did God deliver me from this evil, from this enemy? But also, is Absalom safe? Did they heed my decrees?" So while the first runner approached, the watchman sees another runner approaching, which leads David to proclaim both bearers of good news. It is at this moment that the watchman provides some astounding detail about the first runner. He appears to run exactly like Ahimaaz. It was no doubt uncommon for the same messengers to be used, right? If Ahimaaz was trustworthy and reliable and he was a fast runner, you're going to be the runner we send every single time. So the second they see you, they know, oh, it's good news. We have a good reason to begin celebrating. And therefore, their running style would have been very familiar to those watching. So David comes out and greets him. Ahimaaz comes in. Ahimaaz falls before David and begins to share the news of the conflict. Ahimaaz starts off recognizing God as the source of the victory. Notice what he says there in verse number 28. "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king." Ahimaaz here shows off the typical response that we have seen from David taking time to praise God for his provision. What is David's ordinary response in moments like this? To praise God, to give God the glory. And we see David's attitude reflected here in Ahimaaz. They all immediately recognize this was not our doing. God has been the one that has provided this great victory. God has been the source of our salvation. It was God that provided deliverance for David from Absalom and his army. Even in the midst of God's judgment in David's life, which he is still experiencing as the consequences for his sins, we still see God's care and provision towards David, keeping his promise that the throne would not be removed from him. David is still experiencing God's faithful provision. Yes, God's judgment is still very much present. But we are also seeing God's continued faithfulness. One author expressed it this way: in the different responses, we are reminded of two dimensions of the event, divine deliverance and divine discipline. Both are happening in this moment with the news of the victory, but also the news of Absalom's death. David's first question upon hearing this news is about the condition of Absalom. Is the young man Absalom safe? And no doubt you can understand David's heart here. He is a father. He wants Absalom to be safe. And he wants them to understand how important this matter is to him. So tell me, Absalom, that's the only news I care about in this moment. Is he safe? In response to this question, and no doubt maybe Joab's conversations with him and Joab's hesitancy has triggered in Ahimaaz a fear of David's response. No doubt Ahimaaz has perhaps seen David's response sometimes in an unjust manner in these types of situations. And so Ahimaaz decides to lie to David. I saw a tumult, a commotion, but I don't know what that was about, David. Hey, I saw there was something going on, but I don't really have that much clarity, so I don't want to speak to it. Something happened, but I don't know, David. And so David says, stand over here. And he's done with Ahimaaz's testimony because here comes the Cushite to report his tidings as well. But it's important to note, Ahimaaz's statement to David is inaccurate. While perhaps not present when Absalom's death occurred, it was clear that Ahimaaz would have known about his demise. And so even here, we see Ahimaaz, no doubt out of fear, make the decision to be dishonest to David. The Cushite arrives, and his first statement to David seems to echo back to David's prayer in chapter 18 by stating that God has avenged David of those who have revolted against the king. Again, mirroring the heart of faith of Ahimaaz, God has given us this great victory. That is his immediate response as well. David hears this report, his immediate question back to this Cushite servant. Is Absalom my son safe? What is going on with Absalom? The Cushite responds in a roundabout way of telling David that Absalom is dead. Notice what he says there. The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. In other words, Absalom's dead. Hey, if an enemy rises against you, king, we want them to die. We don't want you to die. And that's what's happened to Absalom. Upon hearing this news, David immediately breaks down in grief, hearing about Absalom's death. Here we see, understandably, the heart of David as a father completely broken. Notice how many times here that David uses the phrase, my son. He uses it 5 times alone in verse number 33 before also repeating it in chapter 19, verse number 4. So he's like, my son, he's broken-hearted. He expresses his desire that he wishes he could trade places with Absalom. I wish that I were dead and Absalom were still alive. That's the heart of grief that David is pouring out here. Perhaps intermixed in this moment of grief is the guilt over the way that David handled the situation of Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom. No doubt David is wishing, man, if I had only done, maybe we wouldn't be here. Man, if I had just stepped in and handled this in a just way and carried out the responsibility that God has given me, maybe Absalom wouldn't be dead in this moment. But it is David's inability to hold those closest to him accountable that rears its ugly head again. Yet we also see such a unique change here. Gone is the cold shoulder and lack of care that was present at the beginning of Absalom's return. Remember, Absalom comes back. David doesn't even see him. David doesn't even want to talk to him. It's like Absalom is dead to David. And now all of a sudden, in his place, great weeping and grief over Absalom's death. Gone is the seeming lack of weeping that occurred when Tamar was taken advantage of. And now here it is all pouring out. And so it mirrors Tamar's grief and weeping that she experienced, David's lack of response, and now David weeping and grieving just like Tamar over the death of Absalom. Perhaps David's wish to replace Absalom is a recognition that David has made major mistakes and is grieved over the consequences that others have faced. You see, David isn't the only one to experience the consequences of his sin. What was the ultimate result of that sin with Bathsheba? We see this in Scripture a couple chapters back in chapter 12. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thy eyes, and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. This is all part of God's judgment on David because of his sin. And no doubt David is broken over the consequences of his sin that has now devastated so many people. You see, that's one of the lies Satan tries to get us to believe about our sin. Our sin only affects me. Yeah, it may hurt me a little bit, but it's not going to hurt everyone else. And this is such a vivid reminder. Our sin has so many lasting consequences on everyone around us. When we choose to indulge sin and allow it to go unchecked, and we don't respond to God's word and the Spirit's correction, we make so many consequences, and it damages so many others around us. One author notes that David here is focusing entirely on the judgment of God, though, instead of his deliverance. Earlier, David expressed his hope that the Lord would repay him good instead of the ruin that Shimei predicted for him. But now that the Lord has delivered David from ruin and death, he wishes that he had died instead of Absalom. David is focusing on the divine discipline, not on the divine deliverance. And both are present. And we can understand it from the position of a heart of a father, right? His son is dead. It's grieving. It's difficult. It's painful. But at the same time, we can recognize David is missing the faithfulness of God that is present even in these moments of correction. The last thing that we see here in our passage, if we jump into chapter 19, is Joab's confrontation of David. So let's jump in, chapter 19, beginning in verse number 1. And it was told Joab, behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom. And the victory that was turned into mourning until all the people, for the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people gat them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. And Joab came into the house to the king and said, Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and thy daughters and the lives of thy wives and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. Now therefore, rise, go forth, and speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, therefore will not tarry one with thee this night. And that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. And then the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told unto all the people, saying, Behold, the king doth sit in the gate. And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent. At this point of the story, Jerusalem has turned into a place of mourning. What should have been a great place of rejoicing, God has delivered us, has turned into a place of mourning. Why? Because David is grieving the death of Absalom. The army of David has returned, but David is not there to meet his brave troops. It would have been incredibly common. The army went out, they were victorious, they come back in, and it's a celebration. There's parades, there are people chanting, the king is there to bestow his great blessing and gratefulness and thankfulness for the army's victory. But David's not there. David is grieving Absalom. Joab is informed that David is grieving and mourning, and Joab needs to do something about this. It would have been incredibly demoralizing for an army to come home, not a victorious army, mind you, not to be greeted by the king they fought to protect. Joab, as David's general, would have recognized that great problems could arise from this. You want to start another coup, David? Create an entire army of people that are angry and upset and frustrated because you are mourning the death of Absalom. What started the coup last time? a view sown by Absalom that David did not care about the people. It is clear that Joab recognizes that the shame and embarrassment and guilt that the army of David are experiencing, that is caused by the grieving of David for Absalom, has shifted to a place of frustration. This is not a good environment that is happening. Instead of one that is rejoicing based on God's deliverance, has turned to a place of grief. One author expressed it this way: these men's hearty anticipation in the sorrow of their beloved king, for whom they had periled their lives, soon changed into gloomy dissatisfaction at the fact that the king, absorbed in his private grief, did not deign to bestow a look upon them. The description of the manner in which the troops, thus dissatisfied, returned to the city is psychologically very fine. Now, it's important to note two things can be true in this passage. David is not wrong to grieve the loss of the life of his son. And David should also have shown his appreciation for the men who had preserved his life and his kingdom. Both of these should have been true together. David continues to grieve the loss of his son's life with the cultural way of grieving as seen in verse number 4. This grieving is not one that's quiet to himself. It is this loud, it is this very public grieving. The king has covered his face and he is crying out with a loud voice. The depths of David's grief here is a shocking change from how David has responded to Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom's return. The repetition of David's cry of anguish draws attention to the depths of David's grief and mirrors the earlier repetition of his command not to harm Absalom. David repeats his command, don't harm him, and now here is repeating his grief over Absalom's death. However, while Absalom is David's son, Absalom was also the enemy of David and the people that had aligned themselves with David. Absalom, at this point, is on the march to kill David. He is no longer David's loving, caring, supportive son. That is long gone, and in his place is this angry, vindictive person who wants nothing more than to rid the kingdom of David and those loyal to him. But David hasn't had that soak in yet. David still views him as son instead of recognizing the enemy that he has become. So in this moment, Joab decides to go and to confront David. This isn't the first time that Joab has had to confront David about the way that he has handled things. Remember when Absalom comes back and Absalom's really annoyed that David won't see him? And Absalom decides, let me set Joab's fields on fire. And Joab goes to David and he's like, dude, you need to handle this. My crops are being destroyed. That's money that is being removed from my account. You have to deal with this, David. It's not appropriate. Joab has already confronted David before, and so now he goes to do it again. We see this beginning in verse number 5. Joab points out to David that his behavior of grieving has brought shame to all those who fought on his behalf. What should have been a great moment of celebration as God preserves the king and those that had aligned themselves in loyalty to God's anointed has turned into a moment of sorrow, anguish, and sadness. We cannot miss here, however, that Joab's rebuke of David is largely grounded in his own actions. Right? Joab is the one who killed Absalom and broke the king's direct orders. So Joab comes in, he's like, stop grieving Absalom. Also, I was the one who killed Absalom. Right? He's created the environment that he is now angered at with David. Joab's consistent decision to always do what he thinks is right, regardless of what he has been commanded, has placed David in this situation. Now Joab is essentially saying, get over it. Stop grieving Absalom. Why though? Why does Joab rebuke David? Joab recognizes the instability of the situation. For as heartless and ruthless as Joab is, he has very insightful moments within 2 Samuel. He does have a very tactful mind. I mean, he's a general. He understands how things operate, how people move. And so he clearly recognizes, we're in a very unstable position, David. We just defeated Absalom. Your kingdom hasn't firmly been established. This isn't the time to start making people angry again, David. Joab recognizes that if David's forces turn on him due to the shame that David's response has created, then David has no chance of surviving. David, if you lose the people loyal to you, you already have the people who weren't loyal to you and were loyal to Absalom. They're going to team up together and you will have no one to stand on your side. Verse 7 also kind of echoes as a veiled threat. The way it's written, the way Joab is talking, it seems like Joab is maybe hinting, hey, if you don't stop, I'm going to be the one leading this charge, David. Hey, if you don't stop by the end of tonight, no one is going to be on your side. Whether it's a threat of his own actions or just the pulse that he has gathered as the general of the heart of the army, there is a great risk of a new revolt. The nation is fractured, and David must help heal that wound in this moment. Perhaps interwoven within this reality that David is that David has not yet come to view Absalom as enemy. And I've mentioned it a couple times, but it's this consistent thread that we see throughout this passage. But that fact is clear in Joab's mind. Joab is like, he was an enemy, David. And again, his ruthlessness as a general, enemies die. Enemies are not forgiven. Enemies are not given grace. The enemies die, David. So stop mourning Absalom. He was an enemy, nothing more. We eliminate him. Joab pointedly illustrates this fact by telling David that he perceives that if Absalom had survived and Joab and all of David's army perished, that David would be glad. And he's not far off, right? That's David's heart. If only Absalom were alive, I would rather have taken his place. Again, we see David's lack of ability to hold those closest to him accountable. And I know it sounds like a broken record, but it's a theme we see so consistently throughout 2 Samuel the further we get into David's reign. Whether out of fear or guilt over his own shortcomings and sin, David has allowed his indulgence of others to further stoke the disunity that threatens the nations. So what was David's response to Joab's rebuke? David leaves his mourning and goes and takes his place in the city gate. David, by returning to this position of authority, shows the war is over. It's an interesting little fact here. The same place where the coup began, the city gate, with Absalom sowing disunity among the people about the lack of a judge who cares about them, is the same place where it signifies the revolt has ended. David has returned to the city gate. David's men were victorious, and now their king has ascended back to the position that he rightfully deserves. Outwardly, David seems to have taken the words of Joab well and responded. Inwardly, though, we perhaps see another confirmation of Joab's ruthlessness and inability to do anything that falls outside of what he views as right. A pattern of behavior that will ultimately lead to David's order to Solomon to have Joab killed. It's so interesting, and whether David fears Joab's death would create more disunity within the nation, David still can't hold Joab accountable. He has to pass it along to Solomon to do. But no doubt this is another building block in David's recognition. Joab can't go unpunished. Someone needs to hold Joab accountable. Solomon, you take care of it. So what are some thoughts that we can pull out from this portion of the passage tonight? I want to give us three thoughts, and then we'll be on our way this evening. If we are not able to hold those around us accountable biblically, and instead create an environment of indulgence, we forsake the spiritual responsibility that we all have and allow sin to go unchecked. Husbands, wives, how are you doing in this? How are you handling that relationship to each other? You are called as followers of Christ to hold each other accountable. And in that marriage relationship, there is a uniqueness. Husbands, we correct our wives when they have shifted away from biblical truth. Wives, you bring biblical truth to your husband when he has erred from the truth of Scripture. We should have a humility that allows that to happen, that holds each other accountable, pushing each other to grow further into the image of Christ. and not allowing sin to go unchecked, because that only creates more destruction and death. Parents, how are you doing in holding your young people accountable? How are you doing giving them the consequences of their actions? Or are you creating an environment that indulges every single one of their decisions, regardless of whether it is biblical or it's sinful? We need to be cautious for what we allow to happen in that home. Members, how are we doing with one another? Are we holding up our responsibility to keep each other accountable, to speak biblical truth one to another, or are we allowing sin to go unchecked? Yeah, I know Bill has just stopped coming to church, but, you know, I'm going to still hang out with him, and, you know, we're just going to have a good time. We're going to go to that football game. It's going to be great, and, you know, I don't need to mention it. That may make the game awkward. That's not the Christ-like heart. That's not the loving response of a follower of Christ. As a follower of Christ, we are not to be indulgent of sinful choices. We are to be one that admonishes and exhorts to come back to faith in Christ, to come back to aligning with God's word. So first thing we see is to hold others accountable and not create an environment of indulgence because of the great damage that it creates within everyone's lives. And then secondly, we see God's forgiveness does not mean that the consequences of our actions will be removed. David is still experiencing the due consequences of his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah from chapters 11 and 12. We must not allow the just consequences from our sin to skew our perspective of God, luring us into a position of thinking he is unjust. Yes, was David forgiven from God? Yes, that forgiveness was extended. Does it mean that the punishment for David's sin is gone? It does not. Remember, David is receiving this correction, and Nathan tells him, hey, that child that Bathsheba is pregnant with is going to die. And what does David do? The baby's born, it's sick. David prays and weeps and begs God to spare this child's life. The baby dies. God forgave David. It didn't remove the consequences. The continued punishment of the sword never leaving David's house continues to be there. Forgiveness is there, but the consequences of sin still exist. And we must be on guard to not allowing those consequences to move us into a position of, God, how dare you? You forgave me. Why am I still experiencing these consequences? Sin has its effects. We cannot be blind to that. And we must be on guard against the spirit of injustice that our heart will naturally feel towards God's just correction in our life that is designed to bring us back into better harmony and union and fellowship with him. And lastly, and this is the one I want to end on because it's the good side of this passage, God's judgment and correction does not mean that we won't still experience the goodness and provision of God. These last two thoughts are really just the other side of the coin, right? They go hand in hand. When we experience God's judgment, God's goodness is still present in our life. What great encouragement that is. It's not like we make a mistake and God's like, done with this person. There's no hope for you. Your life is going to be miserable from here on out. See ya. Even when David messed up and sinned royally, no pun intended, he messed up. There was great sin that David committed. God's faithfulness and goodness is still present in David's life. David, on the run, God keeps him safe. God protects those with David. God grants this great victory to David's army over Absalom. God restores David back to his throne. God keeps the promise that he made to David. The throne will not remove from you and your house. You and I, as saved followers of Christ, may experience his correction from time to time as we war against the flesh, but we still experience the goodness of salvation. What a great truth that is. No matter the sin that I've allowed to creep into my life, there's always hope of moving forward, and it never changes my eternal relationship with God. If I've placed my faith and trust in Him, yes, I may wander, yes, I may become steeped in my sin, but the Spirit will bring me out of it, and it never changes that I am His. I am secure in my relationship with God. David, in the midst of his divine correction, is still rescued and saved by the goodness of God. Yes, he's experiencing this correction, but the provision of God is still pouring out into his life. And you and I experience the same thing. May we heed the correction. May we allow the Spirit to draw us back, but may we always remain grateful for the constant provision of God every single day. God meets David's greatest need while also executing his divine correction in only the way that God can. Just because we mess up and fall into sin that we need corrected does not mean that God is done with us. Because experiencing God's goodness and forgiveness does not mean the removal of just repercussions of our own sin. The correction will come because sin needs to be corrected. But God's faithfulness and justice will always be there, extending out to us when we in faith turn to Him and trust in His provision. Tonight, we're going to have a time of reflection, to reflect on these truths we've heard from the Word and to respond in faith towards them. And I encourage you, take some time at your seat tonight. Perhaps an element of this message and this truth from God's Word has spoken to you and revealed an area of your life that needs some change. The Spirit is no doubt pointing, hey, you need to work on this area. Let's respond in truth in those moments. They're going to play some music. I'll be down at the front. You can come up here to pray. You can stay there in your seat if you'd like to pray with me. I'll be down front. My mic will be off as well. Let's take some time to reflect on the truth of God.